Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this day that we honor the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, the 21st of January. And the second hour of our program today, we will be doing just that, looking specifically at the March on Washington in 1963 and the I Have a Dream speech. This hour, it's all things political, and we should have a very interesting hour because race and gender will be very much a part of our discussion. We have two guests with us. One is a Hillary Clinton supporter and one is a Barack Obama supporter. And as you well know, race and gender have found their way into this campaign, the candidates saying last week that they were calling a truce on the racially tinged debate. We have news to report or to analyze. The South Carolina primary is coming up this Saturday for the Democrats. The Republicans had theirs over this past weekend. The Nevada caucuses were last week. And there is a lot of discussion about race. There is a lot of discussion about gender, and we're going to get right into the thick of it this first hour of our program today. We have two guests with us, and they are distinguished guests. And we would like to first introduce Professor Mona Lena Crook, who's Assistant Professor of Political Science and Women and Gender Studies in the Department of Political Science at Washington University in St. Louis. She did her dissertation on Politicizing Representation, Campaigns for Candidate Gender Quotas Worldwide, which developed a framework for analyzing the adoption and implementation of quotas for the selection of female candidates to political office. Her current research explores the global diffusion of gender quotas, the normative dimensions of quota reform, and the broader significance of quota policies to existing political processes, including links between the descriptive and substantive representation of women. And we are happy to have her with us. And she is right here, I believe, Professor Mona Lena Crook. Hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks.
Hi. Yeah, thanks, Ray. I'm really looking forward to this conversation this hour. Also joining us is Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell, who, even though she is not joining us from Wisconsin today, I guess is a little upset that the Packers lost last night because she's a Packers fan. We'll talk about that. She is Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University. She is the author of Barbershops, Bibles, and BET, Everyday Talk and Black Political Thought, which looks at how African Americans have developed political ideas through ordinary conversations in places like barbershops, churches, and popular culture. It won the 2005 W.E.B. Du Bois Award for the National Conference of Black Political Scientists, and she's at work on a new book for colored girls who've considered politics when being strong wasn't enough, which is an examination of the connections between shame, sadness, and strength in African-American women's politics. Her writings have been published in a number of publications, and she's appeared all over radio and television and addresses various groups all over the country. Professor Harris-Lacewell, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And you're a Packers fan?
I am. I had, this is bizarre, but my high school boyfriend played for the Packers for about a decade as a fullback, William Henderson. And so I became a Packers fan and will remain one forever.
Oh, we're so happy to hear that. So you watched last night. You're a little sad today.
I was sad.
Yeah, I think everybody was. We're always for it. You know, it's a community-owned team, and there's support all over the world.
It's true.
Yeah. Thank you both so much for being with us. Whoever wants to start with this, let me just tell you that I have found it disturbing that the issue of race and less so gender has been a part of this Democratic debate. As we honor the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, he would have been thinking that it's wonderful that we have a woman and an African-American as candidates for president, but I think he would have been disturbed that there's been an undercurrent of race and gender in this campaign. That you would think that, you know, we'd be beyond that. What do you say about that? Professor Harris-Lacewell, you want to start?
No, I actually disagree with that statement. Dr. King was not someone who shied away from conversations about difference and inequality. He walked right into the middle of them. He prompted us to have conversations about them. When Dr. King conceived for us the notion of beloved community did not mean that we should all pretend we don't see our differences. And it certainly did not mean that we should pretend that unequal power is not in operation. Instead, beloved community meant really confronting and coping with things that were often exceptionally uncomfortable and painful for us. But that, in fact, racial healing and questions of challenging patriarchy and misogyny can only happen if we don't ignore it, but in fact, if we engage it.
Mm-hmm. Professor Mona Lena Crook, what do you think?
I absolutely agree. I think that, you know, obviously issues of race and gender are really important in American society. And, of course, we know that white men also have a race and a gender. And it's a wonderful opportunity for us to talk about these issues, which are very important, and have, you know, largely been silenced if we're only looking at, you know, when we haven't had a lot of female and African American candidates for political office in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. What do you think it means for the country? And let me go to the world on this as well. This is a fairly remarkable year. We have either an African American or a woman who will be the Democratic nominee, in all likelihood, for the presidency of the United States. How big a deal is that?
I think it's a massive deal, and it's a really welcome one. But I think that when we look in a global perspective, there's been a really interesting trend over the last few years that we've seen women become the national leader in countries in every single major region of the world. So I think what's happening in the U.S. is very much following a worldwide trend.
Professor Harris-Lacewell.
Yeah, I'd agree that Obama becoming the nominee is more startling from a world perspective than Hillary Clinton, just from the perspective of, again, women having risen to high levels of political office and particularly to national leadership in many parts of the world, and that many of the women who do, in fact, rise to these levels of leadership have associations with powerful men who have also been there, which is not to suggest that they themselves are not amazing leaders, but that one of the ways in which women have been able to overcome, or at least challenge, the ways in which patriarchy makes it more difficult for women to become part of the political process is that their fathers or husbands or brothers, they come from a family in which there has been political leadership, mm-hmm. which often gives them kind of a way of sticking their foot in the door and opening that door wide enough to allow a woman in. And that's been true in many parts of the world that we've seen.
You've said, Professor Harris-Lacewell, that electing another president whose path to the White House is basically through either parental or familial connection is an absolute travesty for our democracy, that you are... you really would like to have a deeper bench in American democracy. One of the reasons you're a supporter of Barack Obama, that, you know, we got Bush, Clinton, Clinton, Bush, 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 Clinton, et cetera.
Yeah, I have a little ditty that I do, right? Bush, Clinton, Clinton, Bush, Bush, Clinton. So this for me is part of why it's important for us to talk about race and gender, and not just to talk about having a black or female candidate. Because, you know, it's clear that, for example, if our black candidate were Alan Keyes, that would not represent something progressive in terms of American racial politics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Hillary Clinton is no Alan Keyes. Let me be very clear. I don't mean that. But I do mean that we have to sort of be able to talk about the difference between the identity of the candidates themselves versus the issues of race and gender. And for me, as someone who considers herself a third-wave feminist of color, the fact of electing another person who would include a line of Bushes and Clintons and would continue that line, I find it actually distressing for our democracy. I truly want to see a woman president in my lifetime, but I do not want to see another Clinton in the White House.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Professor Lena Crook?
Wow, that was, I think, very you know, cogent way of developing a critique of Hillary Clinton's presidency, and I think, in many respects, is absolutely on target. I think it's important that, you know, we call attention to the need to elect a more diverse group of people to political office, and at the same time, you know, bring new ideas, you know, that, you know, into the political process that improve, you know, democracy in America. Absolutely agree with that. But I also think that it's important to also pay attention to the identities of the people who get elected. You know, absolutely ideas are very important, but I think that, you know, you don't get those new ideas if you still, you know, continue to elect people who look the same to political office. So I think it's also important to focus on the opportunity to be able to elect Barack Obama, elect Hillary Clinton for the fact of who they are, you know, as being a woman, as being African American. I think it's still quite an opportunity for us to renew the political process just on that basis.
Why is it that we've only had three states here and it's not a big deal so far, but so far we're seeing that more women are voting for Senator Clinton, more African Americans are voting for Senator Obama? Can you interpret that for me, and is that okay?
Well, actually, this is a little complicated for a couple of reasons. One, in Nevada, Hillary Clinton took the Latino vote on a 2-1 margin, which might have been surprising given the kind of multiracial coalition that Barack Obama built in Illinois, which included a large proportion of Latino voters. And in Iowa, actually, white women were more likely to caucus for Barack. So, again, with only three states, this is what we would call in statistics a small N problem.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know yet whether or not those patterns will obtain, you know, when we get to February 5th. The other thing is, remember, in that group that you're calling African Americans are a whole bunch of women. African American women are, in fact, women voters, and African American women are a larger proportion of the black voting bloc than are white women, a proportion of the white voting bloc just nationally. More black women are a higher percentage of black voters. So I think it's just not that clean.
Mm-hmm. But does it this is the way it's being interpreted. I mean, all the polls are saying older white women are going for Hillary Clinton because they identify more with her. They want a woman in the president. This is more important to them than having an African-American in the presidency.
Well, I also think that there's something quite interesting here in the fact that people tend to identify with candidates that they feel look like themselves or have maybe perhaps share similar experiences to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's really, you know, behind a lot of this attention to, you know, splits in voter support. But I think it's also important in this conversation to notice, well, there are women who support Barack Obama, and there are African Americans, both men and women, who support Hillary Clinton. And one of the things I found really quite striking in you know the last few weeks is have been testimonies of those types of people. So like you know women who are very you know both black and white women who are supporters of Barack Obama, but also you know, black men and women who are also supporters of Hillary Clinton, and I find that quite interesting, you know, to look at how this gets politicized on both sides of you know, the divides of support here.
Boy, everybody's after the African-American vote for this week, though, aren't they? Everybody's in those churches. Former President Bill Clinton's going door-to-door in South Carolina. That vote is crucial to both camps, isn't it?
Well, this is part of the distressing part for me. I've been a huge advocate through all of my political and academic life of the abolition of the Electoral College. And part of the reason has to do with exactly the processes that we're seeing right now. So South Carolina, as an early primary state with a large proportion of African Americans in the Democratic Party, you see all of this early attention to African American issues. There's a Congressional Black Caucus Martin Luther King Night debate tonight.
Right.
You know, they're going to be kind of fighting for this vote. But then what happens is that South Carolina is considered sort of a safely red state. And what will now happen in the general elections is that all these African American voters in places like South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, who appear to be captured in these red states, for the most part, Democratic candidates have ignored. I mean, John Kerry simply said last time, and then we have strategists saying whistle past Dixie. The problem is that, you know, by the way, many of us are still stuck in Dixie. And so whistling past Dixie also means whistling past the interests of Southern African Americans. So I think there's a real question here for many black Southerners about whether or not an Obama candidacy might lead to greater sustained interest on them than a Clinton candidacy or the other way around, right? In other words, reading Clinton as a Southerner and saying, well, you know, the Clintons will make sure that they're taking our interest into account. There's a real issue here about how can we keep our interests on the table in the general election.
Do you think that this could be a different kind of year, though, Melissa, considering the profound dissatisfaction with the current administration? That is there a possibility that South Carolina could move into the Democratic column this go around, as could other southern states?
I doubt South Carolina. There are other southern states. So I have been saying that the candidate that we want to elect or we want to nominate should be the candidate that we feel has a good chance of taking Iowa, Tennessee, and Virginia, as well as conceivably Florida. But I think there's lots of good reasons to not make Florida at the center of that coalition, which again goes to why some people might claim that Bill Clinton took southern states, was the last Democrat to take any substantial portion of southern states,
we should be thinking about Bill. But no, South Carolina, many of the places where African Americans are a substantial portion of the population, the reality of race in America is that the whites in those states have are no longer Dixiecrats. They are Republicans. They're going to vote safely Republican, regardless of who that Republican nominee is. And because of how we count states, any good person running for office is going to focus on swing states.
Mm-hmm. And what about the issue of Barack Obama has really run, I believe, this transcend race campaign. He's been able to attract particularly young people, under 44-year-old voters, but people of, you know, all different backgrounds, and has not really played race here. Now we're into a South Carolina primary where all kinds of attention will be paid to the black vote. What will that do to his, and there are indications that he may do very well among African Americans in South Carolina. Does that paint him as a black candidate and lessen some of the support that he's received from other groups in this country? Is there a risk of that?
I certainly think there's a risk of it, but I will say I'm not one of these people who subscribes to, let's be quiet, let's not mention that he's black and maybe they won't notice. I'm almost certain that eventually much of the country would have noticed.
Right.
So let's go ahead, let's get it on the table, because, again, the deal with coalition and the deal with beloved community should not be that you can be in coalition with me as long as I am silent about my issues and concerns. Mm. This was true for African-American women in the civil rights movement who often had to be silent about gendered issues in order to be in leadership around race issues. We should not have to be silent in order to have representation. So we absolutely must have invigorated, multiracial, intergenerational, cross-class coalitions in this country. But we ought to be able to do it with poor people, women, African-Americans, Latinos, new citizens and old citizens, all being able to put their issues on the table and be in discourse. And although there's no question Obama is running a post-race campaign, I think he's being pushed by the realities of American politics to also think about the ways in which some very old race issues are still on the table.
Your thoughts on that, Mona, as well?
Well, I also would agree that I think, you know, they're both candidates are really in a dilemma here, because on the one hand, they need to speak to or need to try to appeal to groups that are often seen as their natural constituency, mm-hmm. right? And so there's been a lot of attention in the Hillary Clinton campaign to how do we appeal to female voters,
mm-hmm.
right? And a lot of attention to that, and also how to deal with some of the questions that, you know, the attention, very gendered nature of the attention to certain aspects of the campaign. The same thing goes for Barack Obama and the race issue. And it's just, you know, a simple fact of life that, you know, Hillary Clinton can try to appeal to female voters, but the way that she'll get elected or not is whether or not she can also appeal to men. And I think that there's an interesting tension here of having to, you know, appeal to women as a constituency, but also to try to speak to issues that might not be, you know, specific to women. And I think that Barack Obama has been very, also very successful in realizing this dilemma and kind of working to try to speak to issues specific to the African American community, but also saying that, you know, he has to appeal to whites and Latinos and, you know, every other type of possible demographic in the U.S. in order to run a successful candidacy. And I think both, you know, the success of one or both of them is going to really, hinge on that ability.
Let's welcome phone calls. We have a ton of phone calls coming in already, and we will take them at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. All things political, we always do this on Monday at 9, and we are looking at race and gender in American politics. Our guests are Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell, Associate Professor of Politics and African-American Studies at Princeton University, Professor Mona Lena Crook, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Women and Gender Studies at Washington University. You could also send an email. What century am I in? An email to us, and you do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we will be paying tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King. And our guest has written a book about the I Have a Dream speech and has done a lot of research on the March on Washington in 1963. We will be Actually, his actual birthday was, you know, he only would have been 79 years old. It seems young now, doesn't it? All right, let's go to phone calls. We have tons of them coming in. We start with Kathy from Waupaca. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I find that it's interesting that we're still talking about dynamics of race and gender, which are the most reliable ways to divide us. It's a very good way to keep middle and working class people from recognizing their real interest, which is in trying to stay afloat economically right now. And I'm still supporting John Edwards for that reason. Even though I am a woman, I don't think Hillary really represents me. When she said in the Philadelphia debate, made some comment about $97,000 being middle class, I thought, she doesn't get it. She really does not get it. And look at who is supporting Hillary, and look at who is supporting Obama. They're getting a lot of money from the defense industry, from Wall Street, from the healthcare industry. Follow the money. I really think the Republicans have kind of said, we're probably not going to win this year. Hillary is an acceptable substitute. Hmm. I'll take my comments.
All right. Thanks, Kathy, for the call. Moni, you want to start?
Well, I think that that's a really good point, actually. I think that, you know, gender and race aren't the only things that matter in this election. But I also think that there are ways in which both candidates, I think, have tried to speak to the class issue. And, you know, it's just really quite interesting that I think that that's been an actual very important aspect of the Edwards candidacy, is to really call attention to the importance of poverty and the role of class in American society. But I also think that, you know, for example, if you take somebody like Hillary Clinton, you know, one of the issues that she's pushed in the Senate has been the issue of wage inequality between women and men. And I feel that this is really, you know, an issue that really speaks to the reality of women's lives. I mean, women still receive, you know, a much lower percent, you know, they win, I think, something like 77 cents for every dollar that a man earns. And I think that, you know, there is some attention, at least by both candidates, to issues of class in, you know, in this campaign. And I really hope that this continues to be an issue in the election.
Although nobody takes it on like John Edwards, don't you think, Melissa?
Well, I mean, I'm a huge fan of John Edwards. I was a North Carolinian before I moved off to Chicago. And when I was in grad school, he was my senator. Mm-hmm. I think he's just fantastic. In my dream world, sometimes I imagine an Obama-Edwards ticket that makes me so happy I don't want to wake up. So, there's no doubt that I think that Edwards is fantastic. Now, that said, there are a couple of things that your caller said that I want to push on just a little bit. So one thing is that we can't reduce to class. We must always think about class at the intersections of race and gender. So there's no question that class is important, that class is and economic issues are fundamental. But let's just take for a second our current housing crisis, right, the subprime mortgage lending crisis. That is a crisis that is falling vastly disproportionately on unmarried women who tried to become homeowners, particularly unmarried mothers who were working very hard to become homeowners and are now finding themselves and their children facing homelessness in response to this, and falling vastly disproportionately on African Americans. Why? In part because the mortgage lending policies in black and brown communities have traditionally been framed not only by by class, but also by race. And we know that there is a huge wealth gap, an enormous 11 times wealth gap in this country between the races, between whites and African Americans, median white wealth being 11 times that of median black wealth. And it has almost everything to do with historic housing discrimination. So on the one hand, I am absolutely in agreement with your caller. On the other, if we ignore how race and gender intersect with class, then we end up believing that the white male experience is universal, and that women and blacks and brown people represent something specific. And so I think we have to be very careful that white men are also representing a specific experience, not a universal one.
Yeah, interesting. Let's look more at the issues of money here, because it seems as though this is only going to become a bigger issue. Stocks in Asian markets way down again today. The news has been bad, 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 bad. People are saying, and this brings us into the area of Bill Clinton's role as well. Mona and Melissa, I want you to respond to this, too, that it will benefit Hillary Clinton because people have fond memories of how well they were doing in the 1990s economically. They had more money. They didn't have to pay as high gas prices, et cetera. Does that parlay into votes for her, thinking that she could do a better job with this? And then it brings up the issue of what role she had as First Lady in helping to formulate good economic policies. You know where I'm going with that, Mona?
I think there are a lot of different ways we can think about that. I think you're absolutely right to say that people have this, you know, nostalgia from, you know, for the 1990s and the massive economic growth we saw in the U.S. And I think there is a tendency to link up with his legacy here.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really clear exactly what role she played in the formation of his economic policy. And I think in that sense that economic downturn might possibly help her in terms of gaining voter support. However, at the same time, I feel I'm not sure, you know, how much she can actually do to counteract that. And I think it's, you know, if we make these expectations of thinking, you know, that a Clinton's back in the White House, therefore we're going to have the same type of economic growth, I think that would be unrealistic.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think it's also really easy for the Democratic Party to begin to believe that whoever our nominee is will be the president.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
That's right.
That's not
absolutely.
True.
That's right.
Let me be really clear about that.
Yeah.
So what economic downturns have generally meant in American elections is that the incumbent suffers from them. But we have no incumbent running. And let me be really clear, George Bush is not running in 2008. And it is absolutely not clear that voters are going to assume that any GOP nominee is a stand-in or a surrogate for George Bush. So I don't think it is at all clear what, in a general election, it will mean to have an economic downturn. It could very well benefit whoever the Republican is because, for whatever reasons, Americans continue to believe that Republicans are better at dealing with economic issues.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. But it also brings in the role of Bill Clinton in this. And I know that you've spoken out about this, Melissa. Sometimes, and everybody's debating what role he should have, sometimes you wonder how he's being used in this campaign, whether some of his comments have been way over the top. And it does make you wonder who exactly is running for president. I mean, there he is. He gets a lot of press attention. He's a former president. It's all kind of muddled, isn't it, Mona?
I think that's absolutely right, and I thought it was quite striking to see a recent response by Barack Obama to Bill Clinton's responses. So it's kind of, you know, he's sort of seeing Bill as a really important part of this race. And I think it's quite interesting if we think about the contrast with George W. Bush, because at least there was a generational difference, you know, as a father and son relationship. And here you have a husband and wife, and we've just never seen that before, at least, you know, in terms of national level politics here for the presidency. And so I think we're really just forging new territory here. And he's just, you know, just recently retired from politics himself. And so it's just something new, I think, in terms of developments in American politics.
Does it hurt her, Melissa, to have him there? She's not doing this on her own. She's bringing her hubby front and center.
You know, I think it completely depends on how you feel about Bill Clinton. If you
right.
think the idea of Bill Clinton back in the White House is a good idea, it probably helps her. If you think, like I do, that the idea of Bill Clinton back in the White House is a little distressing, then it probably hurts her. But there's no one clear, easy pattern, even for any individual voters. So, in other words, would I rather have Bill Clinton than George W. Bush? Hey, every day of the week and twice on Sunday. But given that W is leaving, it's not clear to me that what I want is a return of Clinton. I think sometimes we forget in our remembrances of, and our particularly rosy remembrances of the Clinton years, I think we forget that we had also held, Democrats had held the U.S. House of Representatives for 3 decades, and then we lost it right after the first 2 years of the Clinton administration, and we lost it until this last election, and that what that ushered in was a period of enormous difficulty in terms of domestic legislation. And so for progressives who saw a doubling of the prison industrial complex, who saw the Clintons end welfare as we know it, who saw the massive failure
to get health care passed. And that failure was had everything, of course, to do with the attack of the right. But there's no question that whoever becomes president is going to be governing in a situation of a fairly balanced government. We're not going to sweep in a whole huge new majority to the U.S. House of Representatives. So who can do that work? I have to say, honestly, I have a great deal of anxiety about how the first two Clinton administrations ran in terms of their ability to pass progressive domestic policy, given that they had to work with the Republican Congress. And, mm-hmm. and that's why I'd mm-hmm. rather not see that again.
They govern from the center. Mona, you want to comment on that?
Well, I mean, I think that that's also a way of understanding, you know, the accomplishments of the Clinton presidency, which is that, you know, if you are, if we have this era of divided government, you know, the presidency is held by one party, two houses of Congress held by the other, it's going to be very difficult to, you know, sort of mm-hmm. run ahead with, you know, the president's party's agenda. And I think that's, you know, we just sort of have to understand, you know, the constraints with each president. The exciting thing is that, you know, there's at least, you know, Democratic control, even though it's slight. And if a Democrat were elected president, perhaps we'd have, you know, greater opportunity to pass progressive legislation than has been possible in recent years.
David from Eau Claire, our next caller. Hi, David.
Hi. I just had a couple of things that I think this campaign has brought out so far. For one, it seems like as the public, we just don't have much public vocabulary for talking about race in a thoughtful way. And I think there is a kind of panic among many people just that those issues are being brought out in public and we don't have an easy way to deal with them. And I think sometimes, you know, the talking about class is really an excuse for not talking about race, since I agree with the speaker that they're aligned. And then the other comment I wanted to make was just I think part of what the contest between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama brings out, especially with Hillary Clinton, is just that the benefits of white privilege accrue not only to white men but also to married white women. Mm-hmm. And so that coalition between feminists and African-Americans and women and African-Americans, women of all ethnicities at times, I think is just a test of that coalition.
A very interesting point. Melissa?
Oh, well, this is key, this notion of vocabulary, to even mm-hmm. Be able to talk about it. You know, I've spent a lot of time being called lots of nasty words over the past couple of weeks for, in fact, you know, talking about race. It happens in this country that when you talk about race, you are called a racist. That acknowledging or thinking about or talking about race constitutes somehow in our 21st century era racism. The other piece that your caller just said that I think is really exactly the vocabulary we're missing is the vocabulary of privilege. That because, especially, for example, on a moment like King Day, when we look back to the 1950s and 60s and we see the viciousness of racial power, sometimes we can't talk about racial privilege. To access racial privilege doesn't require that you're actually putting a water hose on black people and keeping them out of school. There is no question that Hillary Clinton benefits from racial privilege. She can say and has said in debates, I represent change because I would be the first woman president. Barack Obama cannot, if he hopes to keep together his coalition, say, hello, I represent change. I would be the first black president.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that Hillary Clinton is a racist. It means that Hillary Clinton, like other white Americans, benefits from white racial privilege.
Hmm. Mona, you want to respond to that?
I just want to add a couple of things here. I think that it's a really core feature of American society, this ideology of equality, right? And I think that because we have this idea that, you know, we live in a very equal society and we all have the same rights, that therefore inequality doesn't exist. And I think it makes people very uncomfortable to talk about inequality between women and men, inequality between people of different races. And, you know, I think that's part of this reaction that, you know, it's racist to talk about race or it's sexist to talk about gender. And shouldn't we all just move past that? Haven't we already achieved these things? You know, with the civil rights movement, with the women's movement in
right.
the U.S., and I think that this discussion actually shows that we haven't moved there, and actually not talking about these issues just serves to perpetuate racism and sexism and classism in American society. At the same time, I think this issue of privilege is very, very important here, because we can't, you know, we have this difficulty about acknowledging inequality, you know, when we're talking about the marginalized people. I think we have a difficulty talking about inequality when we're talking about dominant people as well. And I think that, you know, what we see here with the Obama-Clinton race here is that you have a clash of different kinds of privileges, being a man versus being a woman, being white versus being black, right? And so there's actually, you know, an intersection of these things where each candidate belongs to one privileged category and one non-privileged category, and how we can sort of see that intersection and how that gets covered is really quite interesting.
Yeah. Thanks, David, very much for your interesting comments. Alan from Bridge Creek, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you very much. This is a very, very important show. I'm a staunchly independent voter. I have never belonged to a political party, and I wish to make two very brief comments and have your guests respond. But just listening to this while I've been on hold, I must say that I wish, since you're probably the most intelligent talk show host on Wisconsin Public Radio, I wish you would have a discussion on the fact that race is an artificial social construct. It does not exist. And I will tell you, I learned my first lesson in that truth in Vietnam. When you're down to it, it doesn't exist. And since then, I've tried to educate myself into the truth of that matter. Here are the comments. The first one is actually a quotation from Friday's Wall Street Journal, and in very brief, three sentences, from Christopher Hitchens, in his article, The Perils of Identity Politics, in which he says, and I quote, "People who think with their epidermis or their genitalia or their clan are the problem to begin with. One does not banish this specter by invoking it. If I would not vote against someone on the grounds of quote-unquote race or quote-unquote gender alone, then by the exact same token, I would not cast a vote in his or her favor for the identical reason." My second comment is that we are in a fortunate position in this country that we have the finest document that has ever put together a national government, and that is our United States Constitution. Article 2, Section 2 gives us a job description. And the job description, of course, leads us to the qualifications of anyone who wishes to have that job. Now, I've been in small business 25 years as a business owner, and I can tell you I would never hire anyone without looking very carefully at their qualifications, regardless of what rhetoric they might use to convince me that they are the best person. I'm going to hang up because I know these two ladies are going to have some fascinating things to say.
I'm sure they will.
Keep up the good work, Kathleen.
Thank you, Alan. Thanks. Melissa, why don't you start?
Well, there's no question that race is not biologically real. It is socially constructed.
Mm-hmm.
That is an accurate description. The fact that it is not biologically real but is socially constructed does not mean that it is not real. It is, in fact, very real. And it's not about epidermis. That doesn't surprise me that Hitchens would say that, actually. That's actually not what race is about at all. Race is an extremely powerful social construct that continues to have very real-world effects for people who are black and white. So that walking around on the planet and being identified both in your own self as well as by others as a black person or a white person has consequences in everything from infant mortality to job prospects to incarceration. It is real, and it's particularly real. If you want to think about politics and the realness of race and gender, I just ask you, would you accept that if we had an all-black woman Supreme Court, that the rulings on the Constitution would be considered generalizable and universal? And the answer is no. Most of us would feel that an all-black woman Supreme Court somehow could not rule on the Constitution in the same fair and impartial way that we imagine that centuries of all-white male Supreme Courts did.
That's interesting.
And the Constitution, a lovely document. I'm a political scientist. I actually carry a copy of the Declaration of Independence and Constitution in my wallet. But it is also a document that constituted slavery in this country and that called black people, I mean, part of the social construction of race is that our own Constitution made enslaved persons a fraction of a human being. And so those are the realities of living in America.
Mm-hmm. Mona.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. I mean, if I were to pick up the issue of the Constitution, I mean, it speaks of men, right? But speaking of men, we often read that as being, well, that's just a universal, you know, we're talking about men and women, right? But in fact, I think it really did mean men. And so there are ways in which our Constitution actually, you know, in its language has, you know, sort of exclusionary tendencies. And I would absolutely agree with the importance of, even if there's not really this biological way of defining race, there is obviously for defining sex, at least the differences between men and women. I think what's really important here is exactly this, the social constructions, which have been given political significance. Women, African Americans, have been politically excluded on the basis of these aspects of their identity. They are very much real, you know, regardless of this kind of universalistic you know, language that we see in our Constitution. And I think it's also really important to recognize that, you know, white men also have a race and they have a gender. And I think that, you know, saying that there's, you know, no race or, you know, gender and race has never, you know, been important, well, it's exactly, you know, those the privilege that's accorded to white men by their racial identity, by their gender identity, has very much, you know, been real and politically significant. And, you know, I think that's also something that's important to remember in this discussion.
More phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about race and gender in our All Things Political segment, one of our more interesting shows. I think we've been doing these for a long time and we'll continue through the election season, through the election, actually, to talk about politics on Mondays, even though we do it many other days of the week as well. We have two guests with us. Professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell, Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University. Professor Mona Lena Crook, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Women and Gender Studies at Washington University. We have one line open if you'd like to join our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, you can call 414-227-2050. Or if you'd like to send us an email, you could do that at talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming at the second hour of our program today, we will be celebrating the life of Dr. Martin Luther King. We'll be speaking with Drew Hansen, who's the author of several books, including The Dream, Martin Luther King Jr., and The Speech That Inspired a Nation. We also want to tell you that Larry Mueller has had a change of topic, which happens occasionally on the airwaves. He, after 11, will be talking about conserving Wisconsin's cultural and natural resources. So that conversation with Larry after 11. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Let me go back, and this is just maybe my personal reaction to this. Let me go back to where we started this conversation. And Melissa, let me start this with you. There's something, maybe it's because I want to believe that we live in a world where, you know, we've transcended all these issues and we look at Barack Obama's candidacy and the people who are flocking to him, and we look at Hillary Clinton and the people who are flocking to her, and maybe I wish that we have transcended all these race and gender issues, which obviously we haven't. And maybe it's that I just don't like debate very much. But I get a little squeamish, and I'm wondering if, and other people are too, when you have people come out and talk about, you know, Barack Obama's adolescence, and it's brought up by several different Clinton spokespersons. And I don't know if maybe I'm squeamish about this because it seems unfair somehow, or because there's a race element involved in it, or not. You know what I'm saying? That. Mm-hmm. That it makes me feel badly, that I want everybody to be nice to each other, perhaps, you know, in the Democratic Party, and they're not.
Have you met partisan politics before? Yeah, nice. I guess I want to say two things. One, when I say we should talk about race, I do not mean that we should infiltrate racist sort of undercover racist comments, or either undercover or explicit sexist ones. So iron my shirt is not right. An okay thing to say to a presidential candidate, nor is suggesting, even though it's Bob Johnson who's doing it, you know, the founder of BET2, who brought us all of that great uplifting television.
Right.
So what I want to say is this. the perhaps the single most racist and sexist element of this entire campaign is that no one is asking any of these questions of the white men running for the Republican nomination.
Mm-hmm.
That what we should be squeamish about is not that we're going to have the tough conversations, that we're going to have to deal with the way that implicitly that sort of racial bias is a part of the everyday lives of the vast majority of black people,
mm-hmm.
That misogynist bias is an important part of the lives of white women in America. That shouldn't make us squeamish. That should make us angry, and we should be ready to talk about it in serious political deliberation. What should make us squeamish and angry and very concerned about the fact that we haven't overcome anything is that we allow an all-white, all-male field of Republican candidates to never have to address any of these issues in their debates, that they don't get asked race questions, they don't get asked gender questions, they are not held
mm-hmm.
to the fire of equality. That means we're not equal.
Yeah. And what has been a large part, Mona, of the Republican debate has been the, quote, illegal alien immigration issue.
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting. I mean, the other thing that I would also say is has kind of been an issue in the coverage of the Republican race has been religion. And
mm-hmm.
I wonder if maybe this is also an issue of, you know, the ways in which candidates are distinguished from one another, right, and the type of coverage that's been afforded them. If I could just speak to something that, you know, the discussion you're having with Melissa about wishing that we'd kind of transcended these issues, and why are we talking, you know, still talking about issues of gender and race, you know, in 2008. And I really see this actually as a cause for optimism rather than squeamishness. And the reason why is that I think we actually can see progress here. You know, the fact that we can actually have, you know, a woman, we can actually have an African-American as viable candidates for the presidency. And
mm-hmm.
we've just never seen that before. And I think that it's precisely, you know, perhaps the progress we have made on these issues that shows that this is actually even possible, right? And I think that issues of, you know, race and gender, you know, it's good that we have an ongoing conversation about this and that these issues get raised in new ways, you know, as we face new challenges. So I'd rather see that as a reason to be optimistic about American politics rather than worried.
What did you think when you heard that iron my shirt comment?
Well, of course, it's one of the many things that, you know, can make you very angry and frustrated the state of American politics. You can also see, some of the coverage in the media about, you know, the fact that Hillary Clinton started to tear up when asked a question
mm-hmm.
or, you know, Chris Matthews talking about her being strident and, you know, and I think that, you know, this harkens back to a lot of the really negative coverage of Geraldine Ferraro in the 80s. So, you know, I think that shows that we haven't, you know, gotten there yet in terms of living in a gender equal or race equal society, that we still see comments like this and in, you know, the mainstream media and amongst, you know, mainstream politicians.
Yeah.
I do want to just say on the
sure.
optimism one that I think that we ought to measure optimism by what's happening at the bottom, not at the top. The fact that people are able to get rich in America doesn't make me optimistic about class. So on the one hand, yes, I'm thrilled that there's a white woman and an African-American man running. But it's not clear to me that either one of those persons represents real change for what goes on at the bottom. Now, I'm not saying
mm-hmm.
that they won't in their policy,
mm-hmm.
but simply the fact of their running doesn't fundamentally alter the deep racial inequalities that continue to persist in American life.
Point well taken. Mary from Mount Morris. Hi.
Hey. I have a couple things to say. To me, an equalizer between Barack and Hillary is the fact that they both received so much money from the military-industrial complex. And I heard that on public radio, by the way. Also, that while Barack may have color skin and stuff, he still comes from privilege, as far as I'm concerned. Maybe not racial privilege, if that still exists when you have monetary privilege. You know, I'm not sure. And I guess I agree with the last statement said that we still apparently have to talk race and gender, which is unfortunate because it's you know, we're talking it. So
right.
I guess we still have to.
All right, Mary, thanks very much. Your phone isn't great, and we only have about a minute left. Melissa, you want to take that on?
Yeah, only that I think that's a misreading of Barack's background. He certainly benefits from some kinds of even racial privilege in that being interracial, he has some privileges that are not accruing to African-Americans who aren't interracial, although he is still, in fact, a black candidate. But what I want to say more than anything is as you go to the polls to make your choices, I encourage you to look past rhetoric of all kinds, spend some time really thinking about where our interests as a country lie and voting one's conscience, and that we must continue to talk about race, we must continue to talk about gender, but as a voter in the voting booth, I really do ask people to vote their conscience.
Mona, 30 seconds.
Well, I just wanted to speak to that issue of money. I mean, I think that that is, you know, it's just crucial for anybody who wants to run a viable campaign in the U.S. And I think that regardless, whatever kind of candidate you have, whatever types of issues they espouse, it still gets to this issue of money and who can actually afford to run run for president of the U.S.
Oh, you are both terrific. Thank you so much. I wish we could just talk all day on this topic. It was good. It was a good conversation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks. Our thanks to Mona Lena Crook, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Women and Gender Studies at Washington University. And we thank Melissa Harris-Lacewell, Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University. She is the author of Barbershops, Bibles, and BET, Everyday Talk and Black Political Thought. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this highly interesting hour, and to John Treader for on-air production in our studios here in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return and mark Dr. Martin Luther King National Day of Service, really, after we hear the latest news. And we invite you to stay tuned for that conversation. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.